It is a Wednesday. What is today? The 16th of February. And this is our very last meeting of Networks in the Digital Revolution, Economic Myths and Realities, the fifth meeting of our five-week course. And of course, it's bittersweet. I'm sure you're all happy to, you have a sense of completion and you're looking forward to the final exam and getting some closure. But at the same time, we're all sad that the course has come to an end, or at least I am. But it sounds corny, but you know, this is not just an end, but it's also a beginning. Hopefully you've made some friends, can keep in touch with each other, and continue to discuss this subject. The Mises Wiki, especially the entries that are related to this course, that's a great place to keep conversation going. And I know at least for a little while, you'll all still have access to the course materials, the chat rooms, the forums, and so on, through the Moodle site for this particular course. Technical details: I am coming to you live from a hotel room in Gainesville, Florida, where I'm attending a conference at the university here tomorrow. So the connection may not be quite as good as my regular home or office connections. If you have any trouble, if the video freezes or the audio gets messed up, please let us know in the chat window, or send me or Danny a private message ASAP so we can try to get it fixed. Ian is asking, what's the next course I'm teaching in the academy? And the answer is I don't know. I'm considering a few different options, but don't have anything firmly on the schedule just yet. So if you have any suggestions for courses or topics that you're interested in, I would be very happy to hear them. Some people have asked for something that's similar to the video series that Joe Salerno and I did a couple years ago on kind of, you know, intermediate level to advanced level Austrian economic analysis, mostly price theory, microeconomics. There might be some interest in that. I would enjoy further discussion of some of the topics that I've been working on that are in my book, The Capitalist and the Entrepreneur, something else on entrepreneurship. We did one back in late summer, early fall. We did a Mises Academy course based on the book. But there are a lot of things related to entrepreneurship and the theory of the firm, management, and public policy that I think are really interesting and I would love to talk about. But anyway, please send me your suggestions and send them to Danny and Jeff Tucker as well, and we'll be happy to entertain them. I apologize again that I wasn't able to be with you for a regular live session last week. I hope that you were able to listen to the lecture, that you didn't have any trouble with that. We had a good office hours type discussion last Friday, and of course the forums and other vehicles are open and running smoothly, as they always are. So today I'm going to try to talk a little bit less than usual, both to leave more time for questions and discussion at the end, partly because this is our last lecture, and even though this week's meeting has a title, Intellectual Property Regulation and Public Policy, and those are and I'm going to say something about each one of those tonight, I also want this to be kind of a wrap-up session. And this is a chance for us to talk about, a chance for you to ask about really anything that has come up during the term that you don't feel like haven't gotten a good answer to. Any questions, any comments, any issues related to all of the topics that we've discussed this semester would certainly be fair. Game for discussion tonight, as well as the things that are sort of formally in the readings for this week. Also, I want to give a little extra time for questions later. If you guys want to schedule a review or something like that, we can certainly look into that. But anyway, to make a long story short, I'm going to talk a little bit about some sort of governmental, regulatory, social, policy kinds of issues. and then throw it open for questions and discussion about really anything that we've talked about this semester. So you should see the slides on your had some good items this week, something from Murray Rothbard on intellectual property, sort of an overview from Stephen Kinsella of some of the newer sort of libertarian political economy writings on IP, a piece on regulation, and then a piece on net neutrality. And I'll try to touch on those in our discussions tonight. Okay. So looking at the next slide here. Just by way of review, right, we certainly have talked about policy issues, political and regulatory and social issues in the previous 4 weeks of the course before today, but you know, I've tried to stay focused on the economic aspects, leaving the political aspects off to the side as much as we can. So we focused on things like you know, the effects of network characteristics, network structure, network effects, and so on, you know, on the things that economists are mainly interested in. Resource allocation, prices, quantities, business strategies, and so on. We've talked about the economic nature of information. What does it mean to call information or knowledge an economic good? What are its attributes? You know, can it be bought and sold? In what ways can it be bought and sold? We've talked about how firms and consumers behave in markets for information goods, markets with strong network effects, and so on. What kind of pricing strategies and marketing strategies do firms use? Do consumers tend to prefer sticking to existing products? Do they like to be able to switch rapidly to other products, and so on? Now, naturally, there have been a lot of policy issues that have come up, but we haven't really delved into them explicitly. We've sort of just mentioned them in passing. Things like, for example, you know, what kinds of goods and services should be legally protected as property, hence ownable, tradable, and so on. The whole notion that lawyers have of a property being alienable, meaning things that you can parcel out, you can sell, you can give away, etc. You can trade in markets. Right? To be alienable, we have to have a way of defining the particular property or bundle of property rights in question. And so there's a lot of question begging here about what kinds of things should be legally ownable. You know, is information, should information be something you can own? You know, if I write a story, if I write down a poem, if I invent a technology, should I be able to use the law to prevent others from essentially copying what I've done, reproducing the idea or the invention that I've come up with? I mean, as I'm sure you all know, these are hot issues in not only in, you know, software and technology and digital music and so on, but even in biology, right? These are huge issues for the life sciences. Can an individual or an individual firm have intellectual property rights over a DNA strand or a part of the genetic code? Can life forms, can living organisms be patented and hence owned by individuals or companies? You know, the current state of the law is very unsettled on these topics. It's not at all clear what kind of consensus rules, if any, will emerge. But I think there's something that we, if we put on our kind of political theory hat, can say about it. Remember also we've talked about intangible resources like human capital, social capital, so-called network capital, the value that you get out of participating in networks, the reputation capital that a firm has. Remember, as we discussed before, people often say that, you know, old economy companies like Ford or U.S. Steel have, you know, their main assets and their main sources of competitive advantage are physical, tangible things, land, buildings, inventory, physical resources, and so on, whereas now it is said in the new economy, the main resources or assets that add value for companies are intangibles, knowledge, ideas, recipes, reputations, right? So think of a company like Amazon, right? Amazon has a very sophisticated IT infrastructure and has relationships with a lot of publishers and other manufacturers, but ultimately the main asset that Amazon has is its reputation, its brand name, right? Because most of us are reluctant to give out our credit card information to people we don't know, and we don't feel comfortable doing it on a website unless we're pretty confident that the vendor is reliable, is safe, will not want to rip us off, doesn't have an incentive to rip us off, and so on. So established firms with recognized brands like Amazon are much less likely to rip you off than, Joe's website, because we know that Amazon makes most of its money from repeat customers. It has an economic incentive to have a reputation for safety and reliability and good customer service and so on. So we tend rationally to be, more confident that companies like that will treat our secure information safely. Is a company's reputation something that it can legally own? If I stand on a street corner, or I post onto a listserv, or I tweet or blog that Amazon is a no-good, lousy, crooked company, you should never patronize that firm. Well, we might argue that I'm right or that I'm wrong, and if I'm wrong, you might think that's in bad taste, but should making those kinds of statements be illegal? Have Amazon's legal rights been violated in a case like that? Well, that's a different question, right? Should Amazon have the right to use the state, the legal system, or regulators to shut down the offending blog or Twitter feed, or to put me in prison or whatever, because I have said things that have reduced the value of Amazon's reputation? Clearly, if I broke into an Amazon warehouse and hauled off with a bunch of books, or stole some of their servers, or physically damaged their assets, that would be a pretty clear case of a property rights violation. But trying to reduce the value of their brand by yelling at them, by saying things even if I think those things aren't true, it's a little bit less clear whether that constitutes a violation of Amazon's rights. We might also wonder, these unusual markets with network effects and subject to path dependence and so on, should they be subject to special treatment by the state? Should they be more regulated than other markets, or for that matter, less regulated than other markets? How should antitrust policy, how should monetary and fiscal policy, how should the courts and so on, should they do something special to try to enforce certain behaviors, like net neutrality, for example, which you've already read about? Should they try to enforce some notion of competition or competitive behavior, or should they let economic actors in those markets? Call public goods, right? Public meaning that they should be provided by the state, or if they're privately owned, they should be regulated by the state, like a public utility, like a road or a bridge or a water system or an electric grid, right? Those of you who have taken economics courses before have probably had whole sections on the theory of so-called public goods that are sort of used by everybody and can be used by lots of different people at the same time, such that there isn't crowding, and that therefore it is argued private entrepreneurs have weak incentives to provide these goods, and so the state has to provide them and make sure that they're available to everybody, make sure that everyone can use the roads, and so on. Many people have explicitly argued that that Microsoft Windows, that broadband networks, even the search engines like Google are, in fact, today are basically like utilities. They're like the roads and the water system and the sewage and whatever. and everyone has to have equal access to them, and no one should be excluded from their use, and the government should regulate them or even own and operate them, in some kind of a neutral manner to make sure that everyone has equal access to the information superhighway. I want to talk about some of those issues in a little bit more detail. Mauro, how's the video and audio for you? Is it still bad? Anybody else having problems with audio and video? I look fabulous on my own little window here, but that's just because it's blurry, so I can't really see myself. Okay. Next slide. Okay. What can I say about intellectual property? This is a huge, huge area within libertarian political theory and economics. Over the last 10, 15 years, it's become a really, really big area. I don't know if any of you are currently taking or have taken Stefan Kinsella's course in intellectual property. So we have entire Mises Academy courses devoted to this topic. Some members of our larger community have joked that or have noted that anytime somebody posts to the Mises blog on IP, it gets 8,000 comments, and it's always the same set of people arguing about some particular issues in IP. It's pretty, it's somewhat of a contentious area. Let me start by reminding you what sort of the mainstream neoclassical economics view of intellectual property is. Neoclassical economists typically have a kind of utilitarian position about property in general, right? That there's nothing sacrosanct about private property in itself. It's neither good nor bad, but it should exist to the extent that it maximizes social utility, whatever that is. In other words, that property rights have some advantages. They provide incentives for care and innovation and so on, but they also exclude some people, so they have some disadvantages too, and private property rights should be assigned by the courts and by the government and enforced by different agencies, in ways that maximize the overall well-being of society. At least that's the kind of normative or ought version. There's also sort of a more positive version, where neoclassical economists would say, if you look at how property rights are in fact enforced and defined throughout the world, you find that they tend to be defined and enforced in ways that maximize social welfare, social value, social utility, etc. Now, of course, as many of you have already, are already thinking, how you measure something like social welfare or social well-being or utility, that's obviously not an easy thing to do, right? As applied specifically to intellectual property, patents, copyrights, trademarks, and so on, the neoclassical economics understanding has always been that, granting property rights to authors and writers and musicians and inventors, it's neither good nor bad in itself. It has pros and cons. The advantage of protecting intellectual property through patents and copyrights, for example, is that it provides stronger incentives for people to make stuff. So the argument goes, if anybody can download, can rip your CD and put it on a torrent client, and everybody in the world can get access to that music for free, then the musician is not going to make enough money, and nobody will have an incentive to make songs. Okay, if inventors can come up with a great new invention and then somebody else can right away, take it apart and reverse engineer it and copy it and produce exactly the same thing, then the inventor is not going to make much money, and therefore there won't be enough inventions. The incentives to innovate will not be strong enough because you can't make money off your innovation. That's the neoclassical utilitarian argument in favor of patent and copyright protection. But it is argued by the neoclassical economists that patents and copyrights and other forms of IP impose some costs as well, because during the period in which the author or the inventor is protected by legally enforceable IP rights, they have, in fact, a monopoly. They have an effective monopoly over the production of their song, the publication of their book, the production and distribution of their invention. And, compared to more competitive situations, when you have a monopoly, the price charged to the consumer tends to be higher and the quantity lower. So consumers are worse off under a monopoly provider than they would be in a more competitive situation. Therefore, in this very utilitarian, kind of technocratic way, the regulator, the court system, the government agency is supposed to balance these two different objectives, right? So strengthening IP protection by giving it a broader scope or making it last longer, making a patent last 20 years or 30 years or 100 years instead of 17 years, gives stronger incentives for innovation, but at the expense of longer lived monopolies that are harmful to consumers. Excuse me. Likewise, weakening IP protection would mean lower prices for consumers for the products that are produced, but maybe fewer products would be produced. And the wise regulator or judge or patent office official or whatever is supposed to, kind of weigh these two different factors against each other and come up with some kind of a compromise solution. Now, there have been different views among prominent sort of free market libertarian writers over the years. Ayn Rand was a strong defender of at least some forms of intellectual property. Excuse me. Murray Rothbard, as you see in the little piece that you read from Power and Market, had a more nuanced view. Rothbard believed that patents represented an illegitimate grant of monopoly privilege by the state, whereas legal protection for copyrights was consistent with, sort of the free market libertarian legal code, because copyrights granted to artistic works represented a kind of, sort of the original expression of an idea, which is unique, whereas a more generic expression of an idea, or a way of putting physical objects together to produce a mousetrap, that does not represent a particular expression of an idea, and therefore it's illegitimate for someone to claim that they have the legal right to prevent somebody else from making a machine that looks just like your machine. And I think Power and Market was published in 1970, and I think most libertarians essentially accepted Rothbard's distinction that patents were not consistent with liberty in the free market, but that at least some form of copyright protection to protect creators from having other people, sort of steal their creations was in fact just and legitimate. And all that changed in the mid to late 1990s when Stephen Kinsella and a few others began sort of challenging the Rothbardian distinction, arguing that not only were patents inconsistent with the free market, with a private property, liberty, pro-liberty regime, but likewise even copyrights were illegitimate in this sense. How did they come to these conclusions? Well, first, the first thing to notice is that both Rothbard and Kinsella rejected the kind of utilitarian moral framework and political framework associated with neoclassical economics, in the sense that, if one in Austrian fashion rejects the notion of interpersonal comparisons of well-being, interpersonal comparisons of utility, then there's no way to construct a social welfare function. There's no way to come up with some aggregate notion of, overall social well-being that one could use to do some an analysis of what arrangement maximizes social welfare. We could spend hours and hours arguing about some of the details of Kinsella's case against Rothbard and what some of the responses to Kinsella have been, both pro and con, and we can do some of that in the Q&A if you want. But there's so much already written in the journals and on blogs and so on about this, then I can simply refer you to the Kinsella document, you know, sort of a bibliography of recent writings on IP, emphasizing the kind of new libertarian case against IP. It would be a waste of our time for me to walk through all that now, because there's so much that's already out there. I might just mention a few points, though, looking on the next slide, or rather give you some suggestions or what I think are some useful guidelines for how to think about this problem, how to think about this issue, right? So, you know, there's some sort of theoretical, conceptual issues and then some empirical ones. In terms of how to think about IP, you know, first I would urge you always to keep in mind that really what we're talking about is, you know, as we've said before, specific, discrete, marginal units of things that can be traded. Okay, so we're not talking about sort of music in the abstract or, you know, literature in the abstract, but specific pieces of property, specific bundles of legal rights that can, in principle, be delegated, can be granted or gifted and could be taken back and so on. In other words, you could buy a CD from me, and as a condition of selling you that CD, I could ask you to sign a contract that indicates that you will and will not use the CD in certain ways. You know, maybe I say you cannot rip the CD and share it with your friends, such that if you do, I can file a suit against you for breach of contract. Notice that the issue that would be before the court there is not he copied my music. It would be he violated the terms of the contract that he signed. Right? So a contract is a more narrow and sort of tangible thing. We can argue about a contract. We can go to the courts to ask whether the contract was breached or not. But that's a different thing from a more kind of abstract, intangible thing like copying. Copying is good, copying is bad. That's too generic. That's too ephemeral. I think also we should always focus on, you know, what does focus on legal enforcement and what that means in specific concrete cases. Right? So, for example, what are the tangible pieces of property, the things that are obviously ownable and things that we all think should be legally enforceable, and you should be able to own them and have those rights be legally enforced. To focus on that rather than the abstract thing that's being discussed. So, for example, take the music CD case, the idea of music. Suppose that I go onto the web, I go onto BitTorrent or something like that, and I download a copyrighted song, and I put it on my iPod and I listen to it. So there's an artist somewhere, there's a musician who, you know, sang that song and played it on his guitar and recorded it with a digital recorder, converted it into a stream of ones and zeros, and then put that file on a server somewhere. And somehow it got onto another server in a place where I was able to access it. So, you know, if we're asking, does that artist or should that artist have a legal claim against me for my actions, it's useful to think about the specific actions involved rather than say, well, that's unfair, you stole something that belongs to him. Well, words like stealing and theft, I mean, we have to be careful here, right? Because it is, I didn't break into the guy's house, I didn't break into his recording studio and grab a piece of equipment off the wall. No, what happened, what it is, you know, I have a particular string of ones and zeros, a combination of binary data that when processed through, you know, certain kinds of software is translated into music that I can hear with my ear. So I have a file on my computer and I have some space on the hard drive on my iPod that contains that particular string of ones and zeros. But let's assume, for the sake of the example, you know, I own the iPod. It's mine. I legitimately own it. I bought it, whatever. I own the computer. I own the cable that goes from my computer to the jack in the wall, and I have a contract with my cable provider, my ISP, who legally owns the wires that go into my house and so on. right? So imagine that all of the tangible property involved has been acquired by, you know, completely legal and legitimate and standard means. Then if we are to say that Peter stole music from, you know, musician X, that's a very different notion of stealing from, you know, the standard one of grabbing something out of somebody's hand or whatever. We need some kind of theory. We need to, you know, to say that stealing, we would have to be able to explain in detail and articulate carefully exactly what stealing means in that context. And it's not clear what it means if I own the hard drive, I own all the wires, you know, I own the computer, and, you know, the thing that I have is a particular string of ones and zeros that Mr. Musician was the first person to write down. You know, what have I actually stolen from him? What do I have that he now does not have? You know, it's not obvious what that is, right? I mean, you might say, well, who cares? It's still unfair. It's morally wrong. It seems bad, and so on. And it may very well be, but that isn't a good argument for making the downloader's actions be illegal. In other words, if the musician can, you know, get a court order to forbid me from downloading, or even throw me in prison or fine me for my actions, essentially what we're saying is, you know, if you possess strings of ones and zeros on your own personal, legitimately owned property that someone else claims to have, you know, to have thought of previously, you can go to jail or you can be fined. I mean, that's what we mean. Now, if someone wants to argue in favor of those kind of legal sanctions, then it has to be a pretty good argument that's expressed in those terms, okay? I've lost my bullet points for a minute. I also want to suggest that, you know, one avoid sort of implicit and perhaps unjustified, and by unjustified, I don't mean could not possibly be justified, I mean is not in the argument justified, right? Implicit and unjustified kinds of utilitarian reasoning. For example, I talk about these issues at the Mises University with our students, mostly undergraduate students, every summer. And whenever this kind of issue comes up, somebody will say, you know, someone will raise their hand and say, well, I've got a band. I'm in a band, and we work really hard, and we write really cool songs, and, it, you know, if we didn't get paid for it, we wouldn't do it. You know, as if that were a kind of killer argument in favor of a particular intellectual property regime to be enforced by the state. You know, my response to students like that is always to say, well, I mean, that might be true. It might be the case that if you couldn't make money from selling your music, your band wouldn't exist. You and your buddies would find something else to do and would not make that music. But how does it follow from that that society is worse off, right? I mean, you know, there's kind of an implicit bias in the innovation literature that more innovation is always better than less. Or in the case of IP, that more inventions are better than less, that more books, more music, more movies are better than less, right? That's what people mean when they say, well, if we didn't have strong patent protection, companies wouldn't invent stuff. Firms would not do enough R&D. Well, what does enough mean? What is the optimal amount of R&D? I mean, remember, resources that are devoted to invention have an opportunity cost. Money that companies spend on R&D is money they aren't spending on something else. Time that my, you know, student friend spends with his buddies in the garage playing with the band, that's time that he isn't doing some other potentially useful activity. You know, how much is enough? What's the right amount? Is more music always better than less music? I mean, it might be, but you've got to provide some argument for that. Simply saying, oh, well, if we did this, we would have less of that, isn't an argument for doing something, okay? I think you see the point. You know, there's an interesting empirical literature on on IP and the effects of IP. So there are a lot of academic studies on how, you know, patent enforcement in different countries affects the rate of innovation and so on. There's really not very much evidence that strong patent regimes have more innovation, other things equal, than weak patent regimes. You know, places in Asia, China, for example, where IP protection is very different from the way it is in the U.S., there's no clear evidence that they have less R&D, less innovation, less legitimate innovation than we do in the U.S. There's also, of course, you know, practical issues about, even if one were in favor of strong IP in principle, how do you actually do it in practice? There are a lot of studies of the patent system in the U.S., for example. And, you know, it's pretty obvious that you know, not every invention is patented, and not everything that's patented is really an invention or an innovation. And, you know, Kinsella has written hundreds of pages, and as other authors have, on the abuse of the patent system and how companies accumulate patents for products they never intend to produce, just to have a legal, you know, a weapon they can use to prevent other companies from doing certain things and so on. You know, in the recording industry, particularly the recording industry in the U.S., but I imagine it's similar in other jurisdictions too, has spent a lot of money, you know, commissioning studies trying to show that the availability of downloadable music, and I don't mean legal downloads through iTunes, I mean illegal downloads through Napster, the old Napster, and now BitTorrent and so on. You know, how much those have cost the record industry in sales. And they're doing this because they want to try to argue in court that what the downloaders are doing is harmful to the music industry. Now, first of all, as we've already said, even if you could show that sales of recorded music have fallen as a direct result of downloading, it wouldn't follow that that's illegal, right? I mean, just as if I own a drugstore and somebody else opens a drugstore across the street, my profits are going to go down, but that doesn't mean my rights have been violated, right? Just because a substitute product is eating away from your sales doesn't mean that the producer of the substitute product is doing anything illegal. But nonetheless, there have been a lot of studies trying to analyze what's really going on in the music industry. You know, and it's these studies are involved and complicated because the argument the record companies are making, you know, is an other things equal argument. In other words, there could be a lot of things causing music sales to go down, economic conditions, recession. Maybe the quality of recorded music is worse than it was before. Maybe the overall demand by consumers for recorded music has fallen. You know, I mean, there's no doubt that sales of recorded music have gone down. The question is why? Is it because downloadable music is, you know, eating away at sales? Or is it because the music that the industry is producing sucks on average? Which is, you know, that's the hypothesis I tend to favor, but that's because I'm old. One of the people who's actually been involved in this is Stan Liebowitz, the same Liebowitz we read 2 weeks ago on economics of the internet, on path dependence and networks and so on. But the evidence is very mixed. So it has not been shown conclusively that in particular industries, publishing, recording, movies and so on, that they have been seriously hurt by the availability of free downloadable alternatives. It's also worth pointing out that, as we've said before, entrepreneurs, you know, have strong incentives for finding newer and better and more effective ways to sell goods and services to consumers. And we know from looking at the historical record that entrepreneurs tend to be pretty good. They tend to be pretty creative at thinking of ways to overcome technical obstacles like preventing your stuff from being copied, right? So, you know, there are a number of different alternative business models, for example, that entrepreneurs can use so that they can make money making music or writing books or, you know, whatever, making songs and so on. You know, you old-timers, some of you old-timers out there, well, you know, might remember the old Grateful Dead model. I mean, the Grateful Dead was one of those bands back, you know, from the 60s. Some of you old-timers may remember the Grateful Dead and the Grateful Dead model. Yeah, the Grateful Dead back in the 60s and 70s and 80s, the Grateful Dead were one of those bands that encouraged fans to make unauthorized copies of their music. They allowed fans and encouraged fans to bring their tape recorders to concerts and to record the concerts and share them with their friends and so on, because the Grateful Dead reasoned that they made most of their money from concert tickets, not from the sales of albums. And essentially, they used their albums as ways to promote the concert sales, right? That's an example of bundling, right? Making money off of a product that is bundled with or is complementary to another product, right? So you figure, well, I can't prevent people from copying the music. I'll tie the copyable thing to something that is more easy to enforce, namely admissions into an auditorium or an amphitheater or whatever, and I'll make money from the latter, right? This is, of course, the Peter Klein business model. After all, last year I published that wonderful book called The Capitalist and the Entrepreneur, which you can purchase from the Mises Institute and Amazon and other fine bookstores around the world, but you can also download the whole thing for free, right? The Mises Institute makes copies of most of its books available as downloadable PDFs with no digital rights management attached to them whatsoever. You can read them on your Kindle, you can read them on your iPhone, you can email them to your friends, whatever. So you think, now why would I want to, you know, let people download my book for free? Well, it's because I'm using the book as a way to sell my bundled services, such as giving Mises Academy lectures, right? So, okay, I don't make a lot of money from Mises Academy, but you know, I'd like to think that in principle, you know, having a well-received book that a lot of people can read and talk about and so on, you know, will allow me to charge higher speaking fees when I get invited to lectures. It will help me have a bigger audience for, you know, online classes like this. It'll benefit me in other ways, direct and indirect. So, you know, again, call me, you know, Jerry Garcia. I'm giving away the basic product and making money on the concert tour. So look for your tickets at Ticketmaster.com for the next Peter Klein, you know, stand-up comedy tour. But the general point is, when people make these arguments that, well, if we didn't have the government doing X, for instance, if the government didn't enforce patents and copyrights and trademarks and so on, then all these horrible things would happen. Then people couldn't make money. Then people wouldn't do this. Then people would not have an incentive to do that. You know, I think we should approach those arguments with a little bit of skepticism, right? We don't know exactly how the market would figure it out, but we can be pretty confident based on our theories of entrepreneurship and based on the historical record that entrepreneurs would figure out new and clever ways to make money from writing books and singing songs and you know, inventing products and so on. You know, strategies that we haven't even thought of now. And remember the example I used in an earlier lecture about the example that Murray Rothbard gave about, you know, the government nationalizing the shoe industry, and it's always been that way, and then someone proposes removing government restrictions on the production of shoes, and you know, nobody knows exactly how it would work out in a free market, but we can guess that it would probably work out pretty well. It's the same thing here, right? In a world without intellectual property protection enforced by the state, my conjecture is entrepreneurs would discover many clever ways for people to make money from doing the things that IP advocates are worried about. Okay. Anyway, that's a, you know, that's almost kind of a pragmatic empirical argument, which may or may not be necessary. Even if that weren't the case, we still go back to the normative sort of rights-based arguments. Even if entrepreneurs couldn't figure out ways to make money from writing songs, and even if, therefore, the amount of songs written went down, it doesn't follow that it should be illegal for people to copy songs. Okay? One would have to make some kind of, moral and philosophical argument to explain how, you know, downloading a file constitutes theft. In what way is it stealing from someone else in terms that we can commonly understand, you know, in kind of political and legal theory? Okay. Let's go on and talk just a little bit about regulation. Not a whole lot. I mean, there's that article by Jordy and Teese from Regulation Magazine in 1990. And it's a little bit more technical than some of the other things that we've read, but it makes some good points, and I hope it made sense. You know, just to kind of summarize some of these issues as they have come up in the readings, we talked 2 weeks ago about path dependence. And remember, Leibowitz and Margolis have these distinctions between what they call first degree, second degree, and third degree path dependence. And you know, first degree path dependence is choices that have where people easily could switch, but they choose not to. Second degree, it's costly to switch, but the benefits from switching are small, and therefore there's no inefficiency in staying with the current technology. In Leibowitz and Margolis's terms, you know, the only kind of interesting case is what they call third degree path dependence, where you know we can't imagine a new path, we can't imagine a new standard or a new technology, the conversion to which would bring net gains, but because people aren't far-sighted enough to realize it, because they have problems coordinating their actions, they can't sort of achieve it. I mean, one point just to bring out, to remind you of some of those discussions we had 2 weeks ago, is that even if it were the case that switching to some alternative technology could bring some net benefits, it doesn't follow that this is, you know, actionable in legal terms. In other words, it doesn't follow that the government should intervene simply because we can conceive of a possible scenario in which switching to some other technology through, you know, coordinated action would make us better off. In other words, I think let me put it two ways. Some of the participants in the path dependence literature think they have discovered a new rationale for state intervention in the economy. At the same time, some free market advocates have been suspicious of the path dependence literature because they say, hey, this is just another way to come up with the rationale for the state. It's another form of market failure. Therefore, we should reject the analysis and the historical studies that have been done on path dependence. And I think it's better to take kind of a middle ground in which we recognize that path dependence does happen. I mean, it is a real phenomenon that is interesting and important and worthy of study. It deserves analysis, but the fact of path dependence does not imply any particular role for the state. Okay, these things are not actionable. So there's no rationale for a public policy response. By the way, just as a footnote, Mauro is having some problems with his video. Is anyone else besides Mauro having trouble with the audio or the video? If so, please indicate that in the chat room, if you can hear me, of course. I shouldn't say if you can't hear me, type that in the chat window. That wouldn't make sense. Okay. It's fine for some people and there are delays for other people. So that suggests that maybe it's not, the problem is not at my end, but it may be elsewhere in the network, which is another reason we need some kind of congestion pricing algorithm, because all of you would pay top dollar to have a high-speed portal directly to Peter Klein's hotel room. Okay. The Jordy and Teese paper talks about regulation and monopoly. It's good stuff. You know, it's worth keeping in mind that mainstream economists often use the word monopoly to mean sort of any big firm that has a large share of the market, whereas Austrian economists have tended to use the word monopoly in a narrower sense of a case where a firm has a legally sanctioned privilege. You know, the government grants you a monopoly in X, meaning the government says no one else can produce X, which is very different from you know, a competitive market for X in which one firm just happens to have a bigger share of the market than others. So what mainstream economists call market power, the notion of having a large share of the market, could be, Ian, it could be one seller, it could be a few large sellers, it could be one seller that has 60 or 70% of the market. But the question from the Austrian point of view is whether there are legal barriers to entry or not. So Microsoft has a very large share of the desktop operating systems market, but there's no law that says another company cannot make a competing product. It's just, it's, you know, it's, practically speaking, it's very difficult to compete with Microsoft on that level. Not impossible, but difficult. But there's certainly nothing illegal about giving it a shot. So Microsoft does not have a monopoly in the sense that the post office has a monopoly on the delivery of first-class mail, because it is illegal for someone else to deliver first-class mail. Only the post office has the legal right to do that. And, you know, this sort of having a large market share without any legal protection tends historically to be a pretty transitory phenomenon. Right? History is full of cases of firms that had very big market shares and then lost them because of bad management, because of entrepreneurial competition, because of technological innovation, and so on. Jordi and Thies distinguish between so-called static and dynamic competition. And they primarily have in mind by dynamic competition, competition that is the result of innovation. And while I don't dispute that definition, I tend to use the term dynamic competition in a more general sense, meaning real competition, not the so-called perfectly competitive model of neoclassical economics. And in neoclassical economics, this particular model, so-called perfect competition, tends to be held up as a kind of a welfare ideal, such that any deviations from perfect competition are held to be inefficient, you know, things that the government needs to remedy, or whatever. And that's a mistake, right? In the real world of dynamic competition, firms, as long as there are no legal entry barriers, firms always have the ability to compete on a number of different margins, or at least to try, I should say, to try to compete on a number of different margins, but they aren't always successful in doing so. Right? And the mistake that we have is, you know, what I call competition within the status quo versus competition for the status quo. So, for instance, people look at the market for search, and I don't know what Google's market share is now, 90% maybe? Let's say it's 90%. And they say, well, that's not a competitive market because one firm is controlling 90% of the market. But the point is, if we just, you know, sort of took a snapshot of history, if we looked at, you know, what the market share, what Google's market share is today, that would not be enough for us to draw any conclusions about how competitive that market is, right? Because nobody gave Google its 90% market share. Nobody handed it this large market share on a platter and said, here you go. No, at one point, Google had a 0% market share before it launched, right? And then it gradually accumulated a larger and larger market share, taking it away from Yahoo, and some of you might remember Alta Vista, and some other search engines that were out there. So there, the point is, even if the market for search, because of network externalities or network effects, is the kind of market in which we, you know, will tend to have a small number of dominant providers, maybe even one very large provider, there's always competition for that market leadership position, right? So how did we get to the status quo? Well, that was the result of competition between Google and other search engines. You know, a contest that Google won. We wouldn't say in a basketball game, because once the final buzzer sounds, the Lakers have 102 and the Celtics have 95. We say the Lakers beat the Celtics. We wouldn't say, well, it wasn't a competitive game. Well, there's only one winner, right? Only the Lakers won. The Lakers are 100, represent 100% of the winning teams in that game. Therefore, it must not be competitive. Well, that doesn't make any sense, right? It's how did they get the 102 points when the other team only had 95? The dominant position of the Lakers after the game is the result of the fierce and intense competition. Likewise with Google. Google's dominant market position is the result of prior competition, and Google is subject to continual present and future competition. Okay, so that's what we mean by dynamic. When, you know, markets are inherently dynamic, such that, you know, in the absence of legal protection, monopoly, meaning a large market share, is nothing that we would is nothing to be concerned with. It doesn't imply any inefficiency, any loss of consumer well-being, and so on. Of course, as Jordy and Tease point out, there are a number of government-created barriers to competition. You know, granting licenses and you know, like local telecom companies, for example, is the obvious example. Is an obvious example. They talk about spectrum too, which is a little bit more complicated because it's not obvious to what extent spectrum is ownable, like we just talked about on the previous slide, and what mechanism should be used for allocation of spectrum. Rothbard has an interesting article on that from the 1970s, and of course Ronald Coase's 1959 piece on the FCC is sort of the classic economics article on spectrum allocation. There's been a lot of writings on that recently. Okay, almost last but not least, net neutrality. We talked about it a little bit earlier during the term. Yeah, as the article by Hahn points out, you know, it's not totally obvious what net neutrality even means. It's pretty complicated because it seems to mean slightly different things to different people. But it has some notion of, you know, forbidding ISPs and broadband providers from privileging any particular forms of content over others. Although, as Hahn and Walston point out, their advocates of net neutrality are a little bit inconsistent even there. I think what's interesting here is if you think back to our discussion from, I guess it was week one, on Benkler's Wealth of Networks, people like Benkler and an even better known writer, Lawrence Lessig, right, essentially have in mind some kind of a view that network access is not a resource, it's not a scarce resource like other economic goods and services, but it's more like infrastructure, it's more like a public utility, and it should not be priced. They would probably say that, you know, putting toll roads on regular highways would impede the flow of goods and services, likewise having toll roads on the information superhighway by charging different prices for different kinds of access and for different kinds of information to be transmitted. You know, that's erecting toll booths on the information superhighway. That would slow things down, that would impede effectiveness, stymie innovation, and so on. You know, most economists would argue, and I would certainly argue, that the truth is exactly the opposite of that. That a resource that is unpriced will tend to be A, overused, and B, under-maintained, and C, will tend to stay in place much longer than it should because new, you know, more advanced, more innovative alternatives will not tend to emerge. It's better to use prices to allocate resources. It would be better if we had a price mechanism for allocating space on the highways, if people paid for using the roads at certain times of day, certain days of the week, depending on how heavy their vehicle is, how fast they travel, how much they travel, and so on. We would have a much more efficient use of the scarce resource of the roads. Fewer traffic jams, maybe even no traffic jams, better highway maintenance, safer roads, and so on, if they were privatized and treated like any other good or service, with, allocated using the price mechanism like any good or service. Same thing with communications networks. We would have more innovation, better use of the network, more efficient use of the network, less congestion, and so on, if we could use the price mechanism to allocate scarce bandwidth, just as we use the price mechanism to allocate scarce shoes and any other good or service. You know, an issue that came up in a previous discussion here, again, going back to the notion of bundling, which we talked about a few moments ago, I don't know how it works where you live, but at my home, I have not as much choice as I would like, but I do have the choice among, oh, I'd say at least four or five different ISPs. That may seem like a lot, but look, there are two cable companies that provide cable TV with broadband as an option. There's the Dish Network. Satellite companies also provide internet access. I can use my mobile phone as a wireless modem, and I can tether my computer at home to the modem. It's not as fast. You know, it's 3G right now. Once it becomes 4G or 5G, it may be just as fast as wired broadband. I could use an old-fashioned dial-up. I could use an old-fashioned dial-up modem and a landline connection if I wanted to. It'd be slow, but I could still do it. Now, how do I go about choosing among these different ISPs? Well, I look at price, and I look at the full bundle of services that they provide, which includes, you know, who has better tech support. The package that I currently have is one of these deals where you get your cable TV and your phone and your internet service all in one package. Firms can compete on what packages they offer. But look, if one of the ISPs, to take a big U.S. company, say it's Comcast, if they said, hey, we're going to, we're going to promote Microsoft Bing as our search engine, and we're going to ban or block or cripple somehow the ability to do Google searches for our customers to force them or to channel them into using Bing. Some people will be fine with that, won't care. Some people might not like that at all because they don't like Bing, they want to use Google. And the latter set of customers will not choose Comcast as their ISP. They'll choose another company. Or if there's only one ISP in their area, they'll choose to go without an ISP, and they'll just work from Starbucks, or they'll use an old-fashioned dial-up landline connection, or they'll get a cell phone, high-speed cell phone, and tether it, and so on. In other words, the fact that an ISP wishes to privilege some content over other content does not represent an injustice or a loss of freedom for the consumer. It simply represents a different combination of services that particular ISP is offering. One ISP is offering this download speed with these websites being privileged and these other ones being slowed. Another ISP offers a different package, a different combination. Fine, let the consumer choose among them. I remember the other day I used the analogy of a newspaper. You know, does it restrict the reader's freedom of choice that the New York Times only allows its editorial writers to publish op-eds and not anybody? Right? I mean, it runs op-eds by Paul Krugman. It doesn't run op-eds by me. Well, that's not fair. What if the consumer would rather read me than Paul Krugman? The New York Times is not being neutral. It's privileging some writers' stories over those of other writers. That's unfair. That's unjust. That's inefficient. Blah, blah, blah. Well, the net neutrality proponents don't argue that because they realize how absurd it is. So why should the package of services offered by an ISP be any different from the package of content that's offered by the New York Times or any other newspaper or magazine? Okay. Okay, just to wrap it up here, you know, there's kind of a hodgepodge or miscellaneous set of other issues that we've already talked about these throughout the course. We don't need to say a lot. You know, how important innovation is for big social problems, economic growth, and so on. The sort of cultural and social issues. Are people better connected to other people through electronic networks, or are they less well connected? And are they socially harmed somehow? And to what extent networks facilitate political and social change? That's a great time to be talking about this, right? Obviously, with what's been going on the last few weeks in Egypt, and in Yemen, and Tunisia, and Bahrain, and other places, right? You might recognize that picture of whale Ghonim, I guess you pronounce it. That's the Google executive who is Egyptian, and he left his job, took time off from his job in Dubai to go to Egypt to help bring about the to help to organize protests and so on in Egypt last week. And he was jailed for a week and then released, and is sort of recognized as the unofficial leader of the protest movement in Egypt. But, you know, everybody's been talking about the role of Facebook and the role of Twitter in helping to organize these demonstrations in Egypt and elsewhere in the Arab world. So, you know, that's just another reminder of how important network technology can be for, you know, really the big issues, the things that really matter. Okay, so we're done. You know, it might, and by way of concluding, it might be worth going back to the questions that we asked in week one. How new is new? Is regular economics, Austrian economics in particular, still useful in helping us understand these issues? And, you know, our answers were, well, not all that new. Some things are new, but the basic models and structures and practices are really not new. And yes, regular economics, regular Austrian economics is extremely useful and provides exactly the right lens for analyzing these sort of, you know, exciting and novel aspects of the market. You know, things that you might want to ponder in the coming weeks. How does all this tie into the entrepreneur? We've talked about entrepreneurs here and there, but we haven't explicitly talked about entrepreneurship theory or the role of entrepreneurs in bringing about technological innovation, but it's obviously very important. You know, what is the proper role of the state here? We've criticized or critiqued some common arguments for regulation of networks and government administration of content providers and so on, but those are, you know, we've just barely scratched the surface on those things. And then, you know, these kind of broader social issues. What's the impact of technology and technological innovation on the standard of living, on you know, social movements, on culture, politics, etc.? You know, these are obviously important things that we want to think about and discuss in the coming weeks. And that is it. That is the end. Yay! That is the end of the last lecture. I'm really grateful to all of you for being here with us. For participating in the discussions, for listening, for asking great questions, and let's have some time for asking some more great questions now. I have not been able to monitor the chat window very closely as I've been talking, but let me scroll back up and see what good stuff I've missed. Okay, yeah, so it looks like we were just talking about okay, other issues with the patent system. Mauro raised, you know, touched on some of the things about you know, patent trolls and so-called patent thickets. You know, there's, again, huge literature on how intellectual property enforcement can be and has been abused. I think that's important as part of the discussion, although, you know, I guess you could say it isn't necessarily a trump card, because someone who is in favor of intellectual property protection could always argue that, well, I mean, it's hard to get it right and it's easily abused, but you don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. I guess my own view is closer to the Kinsella view, but not for those kind of pragmatic reasons, but more on sort of philosophical grounds. Let's see. Yeah, Maggie asked a question about downloadable music. Well, right, one of the arguments people have made is that you know, music sales and music downloads are complements rather than substitutes. In other words, the kind of people who download music would not have bought it in the store anyway. To use a technical economics term, there's a very small cross-price elasticity between recorded music and downloadable music. If that's true, then downloads are not hurting the music industry, because downloaders wouldn't have bought the stuff anyway. You know, some musicians think that giving away at least some of their stuff actually increases sales of recorded music. You know, that could be in the form of having, you know, the single from your album being available on your website for people to download, hoping that that will entice people to buy the full album. And you might actually make more money from giving some things away rather than less. That's really no different from, you know, giving away free software. You know, those of you, if you've been caught up in the Angry Birds hysteria, you know, you can download a free version of Angry Birds and play it on your phone or on your iPad and get hooked on it, and then they want you to pay, you know, $20 or whatever for the full version. I would imagine that the company that makes Angry Birds gets a lot more sales of the paid version from people who first got the free version and thought it was really cool and became hooked on it. Maybe the same thing with music, with book chapters, you know, with movie clips, and so on. Let's see. Okay, yeah, Danny made a clarification about monopoly theory. There's a good article by Joe Salerno the last 2-3 years, sort of a clarification on sort of a very detailed review of positions on monopoly that different Austrians have held. So there really isn't, I was a little bit loose in how I described it, there really isn't a single Austrian position on monopoly. Different scholars have taken different views. Mises' view is a little bit different from Kirzner's, which is a little bit different from Rothbard's, and so on. There's also an older article, it's a chapter that I'm sure you can get on Mises.org, by Dominic Armentano, and it's called something like Austrian Monopoly Theory, a Review and Critique, back in the 70s or early 80s, that also provides a very nice summary. So, yeah, I mean, as Danny points out, the view that Rothbard and Armentano take, the view that I think is the right one, is that as long as there is the potential for entry, in other words, as long as there is no legal barrier to entry, then there's always a form of competition, actual or potential, even if in practice there's only one firm in the market or one firm has a very large share of the market, just as we talked about a few minutes ago with, you know, the Lakers and the Celtics. Let's see. Michael, no, there will not be a Q&A session on Friday. So right now is really our last Q&A session. If you guys want to stay a little bit over time, I'm happy to do that. But there is always the possibility of Q&A directly to me through email, on the discussion forums, etc., but just not a live session like this. Okay? Let's see. Questions about bundling and unbundling. Morrow's point about the unbundling of hardware and software and how effective that was. I mean, that's a great point. The more general point is that, you know, we as observers, as scholars, as analysts, as students, whatever, you know, we really can't say what the most efficient or most profitable degree of bundling in the market will be. Right, that's something that the market has to sort out, has to find out on its own, as entrepreneurs, you know, experiment with different kinds of bundles. Right, you know, should a Happy Meal at McDonald's come with a hamburger, fries, a drink, and a toy, or should the Happy Meal only come with the hot food and the toy, and the drink should be separate? I mean, you know, who knows? That's a practical marketing issue for McDonald's to work out. Will firms make more money selling suits with a matching jacket and pants, or will they make more money selling, you know, separates, jackets and pants, and let people mix and match or choose different sizes or whatever? I mean, again, that's not really an economic theory question. That's a practical business question, and the economist per se can't say anything about that. That's for the entrepreneur to figure out, right? So likewise, you know, will consumers have a higher willingness to pay, and therefore entrepreneurs can earn higher profits when, you know, ISPs and broadband, the operators of the infrastructure behind the ISP, the content providers, if they all remain completely independent of each other and don't try to form alliances or coalitions or write contracts or make partnerships. Is that better? Or is a world in which you have all these different different kinds of partnerships and restrictions where consumers are choosing among heterogeneous bundles of different kinds of services? You know, which is better? Who knows? As long as there is free entry, this is something that the market can work out, that the market can experiment with. You know, you see, and of course we see a lot of experimentation with the delivery of information goods. You know, it used to be to subscribe to a magazine, it was pretty straightforward. You know, an annual subscription was $29.95 and you either had one or you didn't. But now online you can subscribe to digital editions, full editions, limited editions, pay by the issue, you know, longer term subscriptions. You can buy single articles. In you know, in my line of work, I don't know if this is true for others as well. You know, most of the academic journal articles that I read are available online. My library subscribes to some of those journals, meaning I can access them for free as an employee of my university. Some of the journals I personally subscribe to, but then even the ones you don't subscribe to, you can typically buy individual articles for $5, $10, maybe it's $20 or $30. But this happens to me all the time when I'm searching for a particular scholarly reference, and sometimes it comes up on one of these journal websites and it says, oops, you know, based on your ISP, we can see that your library does not subscribe. You know, here's the title and the abstract and a little bit of the first page just to tease you. Oh, by the way, if you want to purchase the whole article, click here, and for $19.95, it can be yours. You know, is it wrong for academic journals to sell single articles? Or should they be required only to sell single articles? Is it wrong for them to sell annual subscriptions? I mean, who knows? This is not a government policy question. This is a business practice question. And I think that with ISPs and content providers and so on, it's really just another example of the same thing. Okay. Yeah, and Mario and I are saying the same thing, right? That when it became obvious that that the marketplace wanted the ability to separate, to have more modular components, entrepreneurs stepped in to provide them. If the market demands bundles, entrepreneurs will provide bundles, and so on. Let's see. Matthew has another question about net neutrality. Let's see. In terms of net neutrality, your arguments make sense, but there's always a but coming with an opening like that. But in terms of consistency, would there not need to be free access to the spectrum so that competition would be allowed to on the spectrum side? Ah, okay. Or do you believe that even with heavy government restrictions on the spectrum side, the net neutrality is still bad? Okay, let me see if I understand, Matthew, your question. I think your question is, you know, if you had a pure free market all around, right, if there was no government favoritism, no government subsidy, no government intervention of any kind, then it would make sense to let the market, you know, bundle things and price things the way it wants. But if I understand you correctly, Matthew, you're saying there's already a certain degree of government intervention to begin with, in that the government allocates, for wireless companies at least, you know, slices of spectrum that are, you know, licensed to particular companies. So a firm that's, you know, a wireless ISP that is more politically connected or whatever can have access to a better or a larger part of the spectrum. And so it's already getting some favors from the state. Then couldn't you make a case for, you know, treating that ISP not really as a private free market company, but as a quasi-public regulated company, such that some kind of public restriction on its behavior is appropriate? I certainly can see that point, and that is it's a reasonable point to make. But it's a difficult argument, right? Because there's sort of a slippery slope associated with the fact that we are in a mixed economy, right? In just about all countries in the world, the government owns the roads. can you use that to make an argument that, that a transportation company, should be, the government should be able to regulate, a trucking company. They shouldn't be allowed to give one, one manufacturer a discount for shipping their goods instead of somebody else, right? You hear that kind of argument made about railroads. If it's a government-run railroad company, then you don't want the government-run railroad company only serving, its cronies, giving out, the rights to have your goods shipped by the railroad as political favors. You want it to be more open and neutral with regard to everybody. So you're saying, what if we treat the internet as something like that, rather than as a privately owned resource, such that users can control how it's used? Again, it's a reasonable point, and I think it's very hard to make that argument because of the gray area that we're in. In the case of the government-owned railroad, you could make an argument, a reasonable argument, that the government should not privilege this railroad company, truckload of stuff or trainload of stuff over another. If it's a private trucking company that happens to use state-provided roads because the state has assumed for itself a monopoly on the provision of roads, does it follow that it would be better to have the government regulate what that trucking company can do? That's very difficult because, in the mixed economy, all of us, in one way or another, benefit from some kind of government regulation. All of us are subsidized and penalized in hundreds of different ways, thousands of ways that we don't even think about. I think it would be difficult to make a strong case that every little bit of government intervention that you didn't ask for, that you don't want, but nonetheless is benefiting you in some way, provides grounds for public regulation of your activities. By that criteria, it's not obvious where you would draw the line. How you could say anything should not be regulated by the government. But this goes into the argument that a lot of people make about, the network being like a highway, and it should be government-owned and government-run, and, the government should keep everybody off and should let everybody on and make sure that nobody's kept off. But again, think back to our railroad example. It might be something you could do on a case-by-case basis. You could say, here's a corrupt government official giving special favorable treatment to his buddy to get his freight shipped ahead of somebody else's. You could say, oh, that seems like an ethics issue. We shouldn't allow that. That should be prohibited. Fine, but the railroad is a scarce resource. There has to be some way to decide which goods get shipped and which don't, because there isn't a finite amount of shipping capacity on that railroad. There must be some mechanism that is used. Maybe it's first come, first served. Maybe it's by lottery. Who knows? But there has to be some mechanism for allocating that scarce resource. The fact that the government is playing a role in the administration of that resource doesn't necessarily imply that we should not use the price mechanism to allocate it. Right, the government can't make scarcity go away, and that's true of a railroad line, and it's every bit as true of a fiber optic line. Okay, Danny's asking about open access scholarly journals. Will they eventually supplant traditional journals? I think that they probably will, because again, they're sort of academic journals. There's a bundling issue there as well. I write articles for academic journals. I don't make any money from people paying to download my article. Rather, I would pay people to read my darn article, because the rewards that I see are intellectual satisfaction from knowing that I'm having an influence on the profession. If my articles get published in prestigious journals, and a lot of people download them and reference them and so on, then I get more academic prestige. That improves my reputation. I can get a raise from my boss. Other universities will want to compete for my services, and I can get higher pay and more privileges and so on. So to me, writing an article and publishing it in a journal, sharing the results with the world, that's like an investment for me that's going to pay off down the road, and I would definitely do it. So right now, the only reason that open access journals have not taken over from the traditionally published journals is because of kind of path dependency, that the traditionally published and marketed journals are higher ranked, they have more academic prestige than most of the open access journals. But I mean, that could change fairly quickly. So I don't think the current model of journals, of academic publishers selling journal subscriptions, is sustainable because people just don't want to pay it anymore. The other thing that's happened in academia is when I first started out my career in the sort of pre-internet or very early internet days, the way you read most, the way you found out most academic research findings was from reading the journals when they came out, right? But now when a scholar completes an article, he distributes the manuscript version, the draft version, the so-called working paper version on his own website, on a number of different working paper sites. There are services like the Social Science Research Network, SSRN, and other free online distribution sites where you can upload your paper and make it available to anybody for free. Meaning by the time an article is finally published in the journal of whatever, it's probably 2 or 3 years since the manuscript first began to circulate. And everybody in the field, every specialist in that area of research, has already read the manuscript version multiple times and seen the paper presented and already knows everything that's in it. So actually publishing it in the journal doesn't add much value. The real function that journals serve is quality certification. The fact that the journal is willing to publish your paper and not somebody else's paper says something good about you. But I think that certification function will eventually morph, or it will drift over to the open access journals, which, as long as they have some editorial policy of review and rating or scoring or censoring certain kinds of findings, then the open access journals will do the certification, and the traditional publishers will probably die at that point. Okay, any other comments or questions? It doesn't have to be about this. It could be about anything that we've talked about all semester long. I'm just going to grab a drink for just a second while you guys think of some new questions. Okay, anybody else? It doesn't have to be from this week. It could be from any week. Or it could be about anything. And Mara was certainly right that the publishing, the publishing racket has, it's basically for academics to talk to other academics in their own specialized fields, and it's mostly for the purposes of promotion, not so much for the dissemination of knowledge. Okay, some question from Trace about currency markets. Certainly markets for money, whether we're talking about commodity money or paper money or kinds of electronic money, payments mechanisms like PayPal and so on. Yes, I think those are markets that are characterized by strong network effects. So some of the arguments that we discussed, I guess it was in week three, about network effects would apply especially strongly to those. And I think we talked back, and if you go back and review some of the materials from that week, we did talk about Karl Menger's theory of money and how Menger was essentially telling a network effects story back in 1892, even though he didn't exactly use that language. A course on institutions in Austrian economics, that sounds great. I would love to teach a course like that. So I'll do some market assessment, and if it looks like the demand for a course like that is sufficiently high, I would be delighted to offer a course like that. Ian, do I know where you can find the algorithms for packet switching? I don't offhand. I don't know if anybody else does. That's beyond even my level of geekdom, but I'm sure if you do a little bit of searching, you can find the technical papers that describe those protocols. Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't know. Okay, Michael, I'm not sure if you're answering Ian's question about TCP/IP or if you're referring to another question. Please clarify. Yeah, Danny's asked a question about kind of gatekeeping with journals. I mean, the argument is, you know, if you've been following the global warming debate, you know, it is claimed that contrary to the standard picture that we're all told, the story that we've all been taught about how science is done, right? An open, dispassionate, you know, clash of ideas with everyone searching for truth in an unbiased manner, right? We all know that is not how science actually works. Scientists are just as cliquish, just as petty, you know, just as jealous as people in any other walk of life. And there have been a lot of arguments that the prestigious journals and the scientists in certain fields at top universities, you know, form a little clique, a little opinion cartel that works very hard to disseminate, to stop or to stamp out dissenting voices. So research that is not approved by the elites of the field, that doesn't fit within the dominant paradigm, is squashed. And one of the things we saw in the so-called climate gate, you know, the leak of all these all these private emails within the climate change science community, you know, where they're actively talking about, you know, hey, so-and-so published this article. I really don't like the findings. What can we do to prevent this article? Sorry, so-and-so wrote an article. What can we do to prevent it from getting published? You know, I'm going to please call and lobby all the journal editors, you know, your buddies, and make sure they refuse to publish this stuff. Or it has been published. Let's make sure it doesn't get read, doesn't get cited. Let's all agree to try to ignore this article and make it go away. You know, I mean, really just childish, foolish, petty kinds of things that these elite, you know, climate scientists at elite universities were talking about. So Danny's really asking, is there kind of an opinion cartel among the elites in certain fields that is enforced in part by the traditional journals? Because there's a limited number of them, and the elites within the field have control over those journals, and they work hard to make sure dissenting voices don't get in those journals. Some people have made this argument about Austrian economics, that the institutional framework of academia has made it difficult for Austrians to get their views heard, and that's why Austrian economics is in the minority within the kind of mainstream of the economics profession. Maybe the kind of democratization of information, even among academics, with working papers being distributed outside the traditional outlets, the rise of many, you know, open access journals. The BE Press has a number of pretty highly regarded economics journals that are free and open access. The working papers you can get from the Mises Institute. A lot of the Mises journal publications are also made available free to anyone. And so, you know, maybe by kind of doing an end run around the publishing establishment, you know, that'll be a way for alternative views to get into the discourse more easily. Sorry, Michael, so that was your question. No need to shout. Okay, what is stopping a change from current net neutrality to a price discrimination type environment? Well, I mean, at the moment, because, you know, I mean, at the moment, nothing. I mean, some ISPs have tried different kinds of discrimination arrangements. Right now, it's not illegal to do that, but there are proposals to make it illegal to do so, or to use regulatory pressure. I'm just kidding about the caps. To use regulatory pressure to prevent ISPs from doing that. Right now, they're not forbidden from doing it, but most of them have been reluctant to try because they're afraid of a kind of a political backlash, or maybe a backlash from consumers. Right. I mean, it could very well be that in a pure free market, consumers would prefer net neutrality, in which case it would be the interest of profit-seeking entrepreneurs to provide it. But as the piece by Hahn and Walston points out, I mean, depending on how net neutrality is defined, you know, we don't totally have it now because, you know, broadband providers charge different prices to different types of consumers. You can pay more to get a faster connection or pay less to get a slower connection. You know, some ISPs meter usage, you can have unlimited use or you can pay by the kilobyte or whatever. And already we have some discriminatory pricing arrangements on those margins. And the net neutrality, most of the net neutrality proponents seem not to object to that too much. They only object to the idea of an ISP privileging one content provider over another. But as Hahn and Walston point out, it's not obvious why the latter has any different effects than the former, and why net neutrality proponents are okay with some kinds of pricing but not others. It seems kind of arbitrary and ad hoc. Okay, Matthew has a question about complexity theory. I believe you said it was not compatible with Austrian economics. To be honest, Matthew, I don't remember exactly what my reference to complexity theory in the book was. But I hope I didn't say that complexity theory is incompatible with Austrian economics. It may be. Complexity theory, which again is a broad term that means some different things, has been used to illustrate and analyze some phenomena that are also of interest to Austrian economists. My view is that complexity theory is not it's not essential to Austrian economics. It's not necessary to do it. It may provide some complementary insights, but it isn't really part of the hard core of Austrian theorizing. It's more of a peripheral issue, in my judgment. I'm not an expert on complexity theory, and I would certainly urge you to look at the literature on things like complexity and agent-based modeling for people who are trying to get at Austrian themes and Austrian issues using those kinds of techniques. So I don't mean that, I wouldn't say it's incompatible with, but I don't think complexity theory is just another way of doing Austrian economics. I think it's really doing a kind of a different thing, but a thing that may be complementary. Okay. It's the danger of having a book that's available on the web in PDF format, is people will quote it back to you. So thank you, Matthew, for the quote. What I was saying here is that not talking about sort of complexity theory in general, in principle, the argument I was making is that in the last two or three decades, as some Austrian economists have talked a lot of fancy talk about complexity theory, evolutionary game theory, different kinds of simulations, agent-based modeling, and so on, about how all that stuff represents the next frontier of Austrian economics. There haven't been many good results yet. I mean, not much has come out of that. There really hasn't been any path-breaking work yet. There haven't been a lot of new insights that have come out of that kind of literature, that have come from those research approaches. Now, maybe it will, and it just hasn't come yet. But the point I was making in the context of the book, this is from the chapter that was originally published as The Mundane Economics of the Austrian School, arguing that this newer, fancier stuff like complexity theory has not yet demonstrated that it makes a big contribution to our understanding of markets and prices and so on, which is not to say that it never will, but just that it hasn't yet. And I think we should be cautious in our enthusiasm for or embrace of those kinds of approaches. I hear some people say that, well, Austrian economics is just a subset of complexity theory. I don't think that's right. I think Austrian economics is a different thing from complexity theory, though maybe complexity theory will generate insights that Austrians will find important or useful. Okay, well, it's 9:45, so I guess this is as good a time as any to call it quits. So once again, I want to thank all of you for being here during this term. I have really, really enjoyed this course. These are fun things to talk about. They're challenging and difficult, and it's interesting. The questions that you guys have asked during the lectures and during the office hour periods and on the discussion forums and in email have all been really terrific questions. I appreciate being challenged myself to try to keep up with you guys, and I hope that we'll have an opportunity to do something like this again very soon. So again, we'll have an exam, and it will be available in the next 2 or 3 days, and you'll have about a week to do it, and you'll do it online just like you've done the quizzes, but the questions will be short answer questions rather than multiple choice questions. And, you know, again, it's not designed to be a killer exam, but it is designed to make you think a little bit, to challenge your thinking, and really just to have some fun. So I hope that you will enjoy that, and I hope that you've enjoyed being with us this term, and look forward to seeing many of you in person, I hope, at some conferences.